Good afternoon, everyone. Bienvenue à tous. I'm Mark Weinstein, the Vice Principal for Development Alumni Relations, and I have the privilege of hosting this webcast with our principal, Heather Monroe Bloom. I'm delighted to have this opportunity as moderator with Heather, and we are going to take the opportunity here to ask questions, and the floor is yours. The way we will approach the question and answer period is that we encourage you all to submit your questions in two formats. Either through the email address you see at the bottom of your screen, which is principalwebcast@mcgill.ca, or alternatively through our Twitter account, which is @mcgillalumni. We encourage you to make your questions as short and concise as possible. We have received already quite a few questions, and we encourage you to continue sending your questions to our office so that we can, in fact, answer as many of those questions today. And if, unfortunately, we are unable to answer those questions, we will try to answer those questions after this webcast. It is also important to tell us what city you're from, as today we have alumni, friends, and parents who are joining us on this webcast from around the world, across Canada, from every province, as well as the United States, as well as South America, several countries in Europe, and the Middle East. So we're delighted you're here with us today. We're delighted to start the dialogue, and it is my pleasure to introduce our 16th principal and vice chancellor, Heather Monroe Bloom. Heather has been a tireless champion in helping us secure additional funding for the university, as well as helping us in reformulating the governance structures of McGill, and as well at the same time enhancing the student experience here at McGill, and of course, involved in recruiting several hundreds, if not over 1,000 professors in the last 10 years. So we're delighted to have Heather here with us. And I guess the first question I have, Heather, is this is our 190th anniversary. And we've just finished celebrating that 190th anniversary. And for you, what does that mean?
Well, it's a great question, Mark. And first of all, any chance to celebrate at McGill is a good opportunity for us to take. The 190th gave us a real special moment to not just focus on the great people of McGill of today, our students, our faculty, our admin and support staff, our terrific friends and alumni, but as well to reflect on the values that were in our foundation. And for me, no one better epitomizes those than our founder, James McGill. Coming out of the Scottish Enlightenment, born and raised in Glasgow, speaking English and French when he came to the New World, landing in the Carolinas, canoeing up to this part of the world, and then after an illustrious career as first a fur trader and businessman, and then a great public servant, serving in the first of the lower assembly of Lower Quebec. Deciding that he would leave as his greatest reflection of his values and his interests a bequest to create a university that would be secular in nature, serving to build the country here, and also serving an international purpose. Those values of the Scottish Enlightenment, of this devoted visionary to creating McGill, those values are the core values we live by today, and I think they give us a wonderful opportunity for framing up the next 190 years as well.
If there's just a thought, if there's a word or a phrase you can say to James McGill today, after the great pedigree and the lifelong experience of McGill University, what would that be? What would you say to him?
Thank you would be the first thing. And then my belief is that what has evolved through McGill and its people is bigger than anything he could ever have imagined, and that's fantastic.
Great. So we have a few questions that came in prior to the webcast, so I'll just jump right into those, if you don't mind. Jane Houdon, a McGill parent from Toronto, mm-hmm. writes the following. We were in Montreal this past weekend, and we were surprised at the level and the extent of student protests regarding proposed tuition increases. How are these protests affecting current McGill students, and how do you expect them to affect new students entering in September?
Great question. I'm glad to have that question come in from a parent, so thank you, Jane, for that. We've had a rock and roll year here at McGill, and it'd be disingenuous to say anything else. both with labor and with the broader political context. So my first message back to a parent is, we are carrying out over 70,000 exams right now. They're going very smoothly. It is not a time of disruption on our campuses proper, and that safety, security, and the progress of the activities that are to take place at the university continue to take place. That being said, I think the question also raises a broader one. If we think about incoming students, maybe students who had their first year here at McGill, and that is, you know, are there themes to the activism? What does it mean to have, you know, tens of thousands of students, and I think other people, not just students, out demonstrating? And I think you have to think about these themes of economic uncertainty, the broader global context. We are a very international university. Montreal is an international place, so the themes that are current in any country around the world are going to be expressed to some extent here. And I think as well it's worth us thinking about the issue of engagement for young people. And I don't just mean within a university, but in our communities more broadly. What is their place? Where is their voice? And for me as principal of McGill, clearly having the university as a place where we get to hear the diversity of voices, where there's not just permission but encouragement to speak out, to figure out who you are. Part of going to university as a student in your late teens, early 20s, it's the opportunity to reinvent yourself or to invent yourself as an adult, independent from your family. And so I think these themes are all at play, and they're different for different people, and they're different for different groups.
So let me ask you a question. Is this unique to just McGill?
Not at all. No, I've just come back from the Association of American Universities meeting in Washington, and there are demonstrations across cities in North America, across our university campuses in North America. Mm-hmm. And we know that's the case in other countries off the continent as well.
Right. Let's go to another question that has been posed by Tom Rogers, an engineering graduate here in Montreal. And Tom has a two-part question. The first is, I wonder if you would comment on your experience in dealing with the Quebec government on the subject of funding and grants that McGill is entitled to. That's part one. The second part is, does this experience have a positive or a negative influence on your decision with respect to your tenure at McGill?
Thank you, Tom, for your question. You probably have your own sense of an answer on that if you live here in Montreal, but I'll try to address the particulars. Let me begin by saying that when I came to McGill, when I was appointed in the spring of 2002, to begin in January of 2013, even though I serve every day at the pleasure of the board and terms come as five-year units, as you know, Mark, my commitment was a 10-year commitment. I thought at the time, and I believe that's been the case, that both a 10-year commitment was required to work with our broad community to take McGill the next step, and that renewal is really important. And I would hope that a hallmark of this administration has been both great respect for our traditions and our history, for the people who are here and have been committed long term, and the importance that we have renewal. So you mentioned it is well over 1,000 new professors now that we've recruited in less than a decade. And so I remain committed to that theme. I agreed to a 6-month extension of my term to end the academic year naturally, roughly 15 months from now. And I'll stay devoted to McGill for the rest of my life, but it will be time then for new leadership. The relationship with the Quebec government is a dynamic one, as one would expect. It is a reality, and this is not just Quebec in particular, it's a reality in Canada that provincial governments fund headcount, and the federal government funds distinctive mission and the research enterprise. Given McGill's mission, and our requirements, and the fact that there is underfunding of universities in Quebec relative to our peers elsewhere in Canada and south of the border, we need to be able to bring a partnership of provincial government. Students must be there to the best of their ability, both so that we can have the revenues to fund those who can't afford to come, and so those who can afford to come pay their fair share. And at the same time, we need the federal government, we need our alumni, our friends, and our other partners to contribute to the resource base that allows us to build quality and impact consistent with McGill's mission.
So you've hinted that there's 15 months left in your term, and I guess you're quite open about it to the community. What are some of your, there's so much more to do, clearly, but what are some of your key priorities for the next 15 months?
Well, clearly, to complete the work that's been underway, and I would say two very important initiatives are the two task forces I've launched. One on student life and learning, where we're now several years into implementation and have made, I think, great progress. We can talk about that, but more remains to be done. The other is the new principals task force on diversity, excellence, and community engagement. The task force of students, faculty, governor, and admin and support staff who participated in that came up with a wonderful set of recommendations. We now need to implement those, and the provost will be giving an administrative response, and I'm very committed to seeing us by end of calendar year having a clear commitment on which of the recommendations we're taking forward and how we're going to take them forward. So those are two big examples. We have very exciting things happening in the international realm. I'm off to Brazil this evening to build on the 50 collaborative projects we already have with Brazil and the wonderful exchange of students in both directions. That's part of the federal government priority to Brazil, China, India, and McGill as Canada's leading international university, and I might add, well, it's a free ad, one of Canada's great internationally renowned institutions is an asset to our country, to our province, and bringing other partners to the table, and so that's part of that. We want to consolidate a model in the international realm that's a new one and quite exciting. Our infrastructure development, you know, we face big challenges there. We have a historic campus on our downtown campus, indeed, increasingly historic out at McDonald, and yet even as we're renewing, we've spent over $500 million on infrastructure renewal in just the last 18 months or so. We still have hundreds of millions of dollars of restoration of historical buildings that are used for our teaching and our research. So building on those initiatives, our first campus's master plan, which has been in place now for 5 years or more, taking that forward. And I talked about international, but a very important thing, and it goes back, Tom, to your question. McGill isn't just in Quebec, it's of Quebec. James McGill came here to develop this part of the world. We are the great university we are. Very much textured by the place we're in. It's an asset to us. And so we've been building on what have been many but kind of uncoordinated efforts to partner within Quebec to build opportunity and contribution to Quebecers and Quebec society. But we haven't done it in a strategic way till very recently. We're building that, and I want to see that through. Those are some examples.
They're incredibly ambitious.
Yeah.
They're incredibly dynamic. So I've got to ask you a question. How do you do it? Personally speaking, I mean, it sounds like you need a tremendous amount of energy. I've known you for obviously several years. I know you have the energy, but what is your secret?
Oh, I think I'm very lucky to have energy, not need a lot of sleep, and I guess I get very, it's a corny thing to say, but I get a lot of energy and inspiration from my work and from the place and from the people who I work with.
Great. Right, well, we're going to move on. We've got a few other questions, and then I encourage everyone to please submit their questions to either our email address or to our Twitter account. And let me just continue, and we're going to switch gears here a little bit. We have a question from Alex Becker from San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And Alex is a graduate from the Faculty of Engineering, and he, too, has a two-part question. And the two parts are as follows. What is McGill's ongoing strategy to facilitate collaborative efforts between McGill Research and the private sector, taking advantage of the growing industry funding pie? That's part one. Yeah. And the second part is, what is McGill's approach to improving the handling of intellectual property originating from research done at the university?
Mm-hmm. Two great questions. Thank you very much for them. Well, McGill does well in this whole area of commercialization and the research enterprise. We are number two in the country in U.S. patents filed just in the last year alone. And We're half the size of the the university that ranks first in the country. That being said, there's more to do, and I think we talked about this at the last webcast. And so we have a new vice principal for research and international, Dr. Rose Goldstein, who's an alumna of McGill, come back to us from Ottawa via Calgary. And there are two new initiatives that we've launched there. One is a new partnerships program that is focused on having a one-stop entryway, two-way entryway in and out of McGill with our industry and frankly other partners as well, foundations and not-for-profit. The other is a very exciting initiative, and it goes back to part of what you were asking about before in the McGill in Quebec mm-hmm. question. We're partnering with the École Technologie Supérieure, which is a technology-focused, what's called in Quebec a monodiscipline school focusing on engineering, highly technical, highly, highly applied engineering, primarily undergraduate and master's level. And we're collaborating with them, bringing our whole comprehensive array of research activity and, frankly, the educational programs in our professional faculties to build a quartier innovation. It's to build a community redevelopment initiative in the south end, in the port of Montreal, to support the between 700 and 800 small and medium-sized enterprises in that area. And one of the things we've seen, just for our international colleagues who are online, the economy of Canada is increasingly, like many countries in Europe, for example, an economy driven by small and medium-sized enterprises, not dominantly by the major multinationals. And what we've seen in other countries is that the experiment of having technical programs and research-intensive universities like McGill work in the areas of small, medium-sized enterprise brings new economy practices to old economy industry and provides the opportunity for job, applied experience and learning for our students, possibilities of jobs, and then bringing in partners, the Quartier Innovation. We really plan to be not a science park, not an industrial park, but a mixed community serving from a housing point of view a range of economic backgrounds, but bringing together creative services and professional services with technology development and transfer.
It sounds extremely...
It's a long answer.
It sounds extremely ambitious and extremely exciting.
Yeah.
But although it sounds like it would be a hub of research and innovation,
what
are some of the potential outputs that we might see from this endeavor?
So it's a great point. So McGill has historically been very, very strong on the quality of our research, on research impact scores, and part of the Task Force on Diversity, Excellence, and Community Engagement, one of the big recommendations was to add to our sense of our public purposes a commitment that the product of our research and scholarship, whether it's in the public policy realm or the musical realm or in new products and processes and industry, will actually be realized. And so we want to keep all the quality of our science and our broad scholarly enterprise, but build the impact and the products. Interestingly, in the context of the Quartier Innovation, we've worked with a number of people who have looked at what are new ways of building economic development through new industry. And the area of medical devices is one where, in this partnership with ATS, McGill's extraordinary biomedical, bioengineering science base can couple with the applied hands-on technology of ATS to really make a difference in that realm.
So not to harp on this, but I've got another question related to this.
You want an answer? I haven't given.
It sounds... as I said, quite ambitious, but at the same time, the actual opportunities for our professors at McGill and the students, what does this mean for them, the Quartier Innovation?
Well, it means everything from, as I said, an enormous wealth of opportunities and internships, and again, not only in industry, though many new industry opportunities. It means as well opportunities for our students in social work, architecture, mm-hmm. management, law, education to interact in the redevelopment of the community with the people who are in that community, both those who are in businesses there and those who are living there or doing other things there.
So we've got a question from Michael Primiani. There's several questions he's provided to us, and we'll try to address one or two of them because there's quite a few, and perhaps we'll also answer the other ones offline to give everybody an opportunity to ask their questions. One question Michael poses, and he's from Montreal as well, is, are surveys designed by internal groups or by external so-called professional agencies? How much student input goes into surveys of student satisfaction?
How much surveys of student satisfaction are, Michael, the students? That's it. That is what goes into them. So.
And another question related to a former question that was asked was, has the administration addressed the rising sentiment of frustration and dissent that has been witnessed in recent months?
First of all, to answer that, one would have to say there's been a rising sense of frustration and so forth. I think there have been some voices of dissent and frustration. One of the great things that's happened this year is how many people who normally don't speak out have come out to speak out, and frankly, students who have come out to vote. Unprecedented in the modern history, at least, of the university. So I would say, yes, there have been some voices of dissent. There have been some voices of great support. And most importantly, there have been a diversity of voices. For me and the academic leadership team of the university, it's been a terrific year with respect to, so on the engagement mm-hmm. point, to just going out and meeting with student groups right across the university, across our campuses, and also meeting with colleagues across the university. And it, like the task forces, show that there's no one voice at McGill. There's no one hold on opinion. And it would be troubling if that were the case. This is a university. So I would say as well, Michael, and I don't know exactly where your question's going. Maybe some of these others would point to it. But I'd say one of the great challenges of running a university that has a community of almost 50,000 people day in and day out. When you think about our students, our staff, our volunteers, people who come in to work on a part-time basis in the university, is how does one communicate and how does one communicate effectively in a world of social media? And this is clearly one way of doing it that we're doing for the first time this year. But there can never be enough communication. And I would say, you know, my notion of leadership is a very distributed model of leadership. It's the only way a big, complex organization can run. So it means also thinking about multiple ways of engaging and communicating at the local level of programs and departments and faculties as well as the university as a whole.
So I'm going to switch gears now. We have another request that came in earlier on, and now we also understand there's quite a few questions coming in, so I'd like to get to those soon. But we have one more that came in before we started from Mr. Bernhard Duchting, who is a science graduate in Germany. So welcome. We're delighted you're actively engaged with us this afternoon. He has a three-part question, so please let's try to keep the questions concise, but they're all interrelated. So I'll read the question out, and here we go. How can we facilitate communication between McGill alumni chapter members, either by mail or by a community portal? It is sometimes difficult to reach out and maintain current email lists. How can we best equip chapter leaders with pertinent updates about McGill, student life, mm-hmm. achievement and awards? Perhaps a video messaging might make sense. And the third question is, how can we better attract McGill graduates to local McGill chapters?
Great, great questions. Excuse me. Let me begin. It's a very rainy day here in Montreal, so you're hearing it. Excuse me. We are, first of all, let me say, we're very engaged with Germany, and Vice Principal Goldstein, who I was just talking about, was part of a Canadian mission of senior leadership of the research-intensive universities in Canada to Germany as part of expanding McGill's long-standing collaborations there. I'm hoping you know how to connect with your local alumni chapter, but if you don't, we will make sure you get those coordinates after this webcast. I'd say that in the last 7 years in particular, we have done much, and I credit you and your team, Mark, with engaging social media, and we really get the feedback that we're now extremely progressive amongst universities and using e-means of reaching out to our alumni, of supporting our alumni chapters. We've used a range of methodologies. So, for example, when I or others from the university are in a city giving a talk or therefore, for example, research purposes or recruitment purposes, we might sometimes put a little tail ad in one of the local papers to just reach out to people who may be McGill alums, letting them know when our alumni event is taking place. So a range of mechanisms to do that. And as I say, I think you've done a great job with your team in advancing those. But we really want suggestions as well from our alumni. So if you feel there are ways that we could do better, we want to do that. Our alumni chapters are very engaged as a group. We tend to bring the heads of them onto our downtown campus at least once a year. And you'll say if it's twice, I meet with them once a year campus. Yeah. And then when any members of the academic leadership team and the team broadly are out and about, we try and do the same thing, bring them together. But again, suggestions from all of our people who are participating today are most welcome.
So in relation to that theme, some would say that McGill has a special international character. What does that mean, and why do we think that way?
Yeah. Well, again, back to our founder, who was a pioneer from another continent. in terms of the research mission to university, and we think of ourselves now as research intensive and student centered. That's our our goal, and in a way, our motto. We have an extremely diverse undergraduate full-time student body, over 160 countries represented in our full-time student body in any 1 year. Our professorate is hugely international. Of the over 1,000 professors we've recruited, over 600 have come from countries around the world. And our reputation is international. As I said, I'm very, excuse me, this is unfortunate. I'm going to take a cough candle. Sorry. We have these international research collaborations everywhere. So there's nothing we do that isn't international.
Mm-hmm.
Some days I think we're better known for what we're doing around the world because our people are so connected internationally than we are sometimes at home because we don't advertise, we don't put the effort into public relations or advertising, as it were, the way others might.
Now, you and I had the privilege of being in London a few weeks ago, and it was a combination of alumni relations and, of course, some corporate relations, and, of course, we had interrelationships with other universities in the UK. And you were very struck about the work that was being done, for example, between our neuroscientists and Imperial College, and, of course, our interrelationship with Oxford. Could you explain what that really means? Because we are talking about a very different kind of a program.
Happy to talk about that. Well, as you... Sorry. I'd like to do an ad for a cough candy right now, but clearly don't have the one that would work. Our professors are engaged in international scholarly and research collaboration all around the world. So when we think about how to build strategic advantage from the fact that we're so international and we're so well known, both to serve locally but also to serve at the global level, doing more of the same isn't the way we think about it. Our professors are very creative. Our students are internationally mobile. So we've taken some of the top themes from our academic strategy, developed in a consultation led by our provost, Tony Massey, and taking our themes where we are clearly ranked in the top 5, 10 in the world, or could be, you know, just shy of that and could be in the 5, 7 years ahead, thinking about strategically who are good interinstitutional partners for us on the world stage. Again, to think about how we grow our ability to contribute in this global context, and science is extraordinarily global right now. Scholarly collaborations are increasingly team and international in their orientation. And so take neurosciences as the example that you gave. We have chosen a couple of European universities, ETH Zurich, ZNZ, the Research Institute, Imperial College and Oxford, as prime collaborators in the neurosciences area. And we are working together on a co-funded and competitively funded model of research collaboration with graduate student mobility built into it. It's a really exciting prospect, and neuroscience is one area, sustainability, biofuels, energy, another one.
So what are some of the successful markers or ingredients to make it really turn this into great?
Well, one is that these teams that, you know, it's very hard for national governments and certainly for state and provincial governments today to say we're going to put a lot of money into international research collaboration. We're working to invest locally in the infrastructure in support of the local research enterprise. And so we feel that having the teams come together, often seed funded by our alumni or by generous friends of the university, to allow our professors to do one or two workshops, typically one here and one there, to develop research proposals that say, let's take the best of what you do and the best of what we do, that leverage up our intellectual and scientific ability, and create a broader proposal that has a number of elements to take forward, and often very interdisciplinary. So engineering and medicine, for example, coming together in these. And then putting them into international competition through the European Union, through Canadian research programs, through other programs, depending again who the partners are, through some of the great foundations that fund really top quality research.
I would imagine it's a very competitive marketplace right now.
Hugely.
Do you want to give us your views on the day-to-day tasks of a principal and the competitiveness?
Well, I think we are in a world, you know, I believe this for over a decade, where there is zero room for complacency. We are always doing the best we can to support high quality, to support people to use their talents fully, and to choose our priorities and to choose the areas that we are going to be assiduous in pressing ahead in the innovation that we bring, and both in our teaching and our research and in the interaction of the two, and never losing sight of the fact that, you know, we're a small country. Mm-hmm. Canada has fewer people than the state of California. So if we are not strategic about what we do, not just as an institution, but as a province, as a country, the rest of the world doesn't care how we're faring. And you could say that for virtually any jurisdiction in the world right now. You know, 15 years ago, you wouldn't have said you could say that about the U.S., but today, you know, I think it's reasonable to say what's going to happen as we see other countries rising to the top of the world in terms of their economic growth and productivity, in terms of their commitment to post-secondary education and research. And if we only look at our progress against our own benchmarks and don't look out more broadly, we'll lose out. And so these very strategic partnerships help all of us to say, you know, we're going to keep pushing, to understand what the broader context is, to understand what we should be doing to push the boundaries to the next level. And then also, you know, back to the earlier question, making sure the benefits of that work are developed locally and internationally.
You are a
tour de force as someone leading the charge for higher education. And we're obviously thrilled that you've been at McGill 9 years and you've got clearly 15 more months to go. But this question that comes from Barbara Moore is a great question, because we always wonder what is the viability of maintaining quality education at McGill in the long term. Mm-hmm. And so Barbara submits this question as three of her children are graduates at McGill, and clearly somebody who has Quebec roots, but someone who's worried about that component. And so if you give us your thoughts perhaps on the maintaining the quality of education at McGill in the long term.
Yeah. Well, Barbara, thank you very much for your question. And it's why I launched the Task Force on Student Life and Learning. We were, to my knowledge, the first research-intensive university in North America. And I frankly don't know of any other examples that before our task force said we're going to commit ourselves to saying that our undergraduate students, who are extraordinary in the intellectual and academic capacity they bring to the university, are going to be here, and in spite of the research. I think that's been the tradition at research-intensive universities. Our commitment has been to say, how do we make the undergraduate student experience and our undergraduate students then benefit from this extraordinary research and scholarly enterprise here. And we've made huge gains in that area. Every faculty has a strategy now in place to do exactly that. Some moving faster than others, but everyone making progress. And look, for almost 200 years, one could have said, how could McGill retain its quality in teaching or in research or in this or that? And we've prevailed, and I think there's something in the DNA of McGill that is committed to excellence and quality that forces us every day to make the tough choices, and we'll continue to do that, and with a very special attention, frankly, to the undergraduate student experience. We are, with roughly 34,000 students at McGill, we are now a medium-sized Canadian university, medium to large by American standards, just by comparison. That's large. We are underfunded by roughly $100 million and more. In fact, recent figures would say higher than that, against peer universities outside of Quebec in Canada, and by over half $1 billion compared to the public university south of the border. And in spite of that, rankings aren't everything, but you see, we prevail in the right direction in every one of those. Our students are proud of the fact that they're here and that they're alums of McGill. And again, we can't be complacent on the quality of our teaching and learning any more than we can on anything else that we do, and we're quite committed to building the quality far from letting it deteriorate.
Are you a little nervous about potential restrictions that may be coming down from the government, and also at the same time escalating costs that you see day to day at McGill? Because clearly we have a very large deferred maintenance problem. But beyond that, just the revenue sources, is that worrisome for you?
Yeah, well, we've actually moved over the last decade to be less and less dependent on any one government. That being said, we are, as I said, a Quebec institution, and we depend on stable, effective levels of support from the Quebec government. Over 55% of our undergraduate students come from the province of Quebec, over half of whom have French as their first language. That's part of our public role and commitment, and it's part of what makes McGill great, as I said. There is widespread evidence that over-regulating kills quality. So this, Barbara, goes back to your question, and so we are not alone, but with the Quebec University leaders, in a real engagement with the government of Quebec about what the right balance is. We at McGill are totally committed to accountability. In fact, we have a well-defined set of key performance indicators that we work to, that we report to our board on. We have a very engaged and effective board and governance system. It's not productive to have layer on layer of costly bureaucracy over that. So we need to find the right balance, but never as a way of saying that accountability isn't important. It's clearly a deeply held value, mm-hmm. and commitment of us at McGill.
And McGill, of course, plays a pivotal role on the American Association of Colleges and Universities.
Yeah.
And you have obviously deep knowledge and great expertise in that field. Quebec is not isolated case in this situation.
Look at California. Look at California. You know, the arguably the gold standard for a public university system in the world has within the last 5 years experienced extraordinary new regulation. I'm actually going in a bit of a different direction where any student coming from outside of the state has to pay the cost of their education, roughly $35,000 a year. And deep regulations on the way the universities operate in the state, the interest not just of governments but the public to have accountability and good management and transparency in the way public institutions operate is, I think, a healthy trend. What isn't is for non-experts to assume they have expertise in how to do this. People who've run large governments or run large corporations who know what it's like to run a large, complex university would say there's no job tougher than running a large, complex university. I don't feel it's tough, but it is complicated, and it demands, frankly, the expertise of hundreds of people within our university context, both our volunteers on our board, but also the trained professionals right across the university, and no kind of notion of what the right thing is substitutes for the facts or for professional knowledge and engagement.
I'm going to switch to two questions that are interrelated but relate to the student, the task force on student life and learning, which was the first task force that we completed here in your first term. And I guess just as a preface to the two questions, maybe explain what a task force does to the audience, because people may not have an idea of what kind of endeavor it really means and how it mobilizes the community here internally.
So clearly, certainly for me as principal, you don't want to start a task force every day. You want to choose themes very carefully, and the way I've chosen the two themes that I've launched task forces around is to think of what are themes we ought to be preoccupied with in every single decision we make at the level of the senior table, and where we're not. And so back to Barbara, your question, my view is that whether you're the VP of Research or the VP of Administration and Finance or the Provost or myself or our VP in charge of Development and Alumni, we shouldn't be taking decisions without thinking about how does this affect the average student in the university. And like many universities, that was not the integrated way we approached our decision making. And I saw that in the first 18 months of being principal, and frankly that wasn't different than other universities that I've been at. So I thought one way we could do that is to so it's an ad hoc group with terms of reference that I created in both cases on themes that I think are of critical importance to get the whole university thinking about, and where, as principal, by launching them, people will expect there will be an action plan that will work to improve our own progress on whatever milestones we set for ourselves. And then to bring together a group of people who are not, we have all kinds of advisory processes and governance processes where who sits on those groups is determined by virtue of our statutes or our regulations or our agreements. This just says, let's move out beyond that group of people who have a lot of influence and interaction to take people who represent the average great professor, the average great admin and support staff, the average great student who wants to come together with us to think through
these
issues.
It's a real collective effort.
It's a great collective effort. And then the first step we take is to send out an invitation for anyone to give input to it in the broader
community. And time frames are about a year or so?
18 months, I'd say, both of them have taken. So very comprehensive. And then we have hearings. So groups submit written reports and tons of recommendations or experiences or problems that they think we should be thinking about. And then we have days of hearings of inviting people in to present. So it's a great learning and engagement process. And then, as I say, we come out with a report that's developed collectively, working groups within the task force, taking different themes and us working out, you know, everyone has their own favorite theme that they come to the task force with, and then we say, okay, well, that's your favorite theme. Look, there are another 1,000. How do we as McGill take these and make sense of it and make the place better through them?
So we have two questions related to that. Well, one question comes from Arthur Lau in Pointe Claire, who is also an emeritus governor. How are you planning to increase the undergraduate participation in research? And I presume part of that was probably discussed at the task force level. So perhaps you can explain.
Very much. And Arthur, I think the way that is best to describe it is that in the relationship between the provost, our vice president academic, who also holds budget responsibility, and the deans of our faculties, a program is being set, a set of goals and actions to be taken with every single faculty to advance the opportunities for undergraduate students to experience research, and those have grown enormously. You'll know engineering and dentistry and architecture well. What's one of the really exciting outgrowths, I think, is what's happening in the Faculty of Arts. And for those of you who haven't been back to McGill in some time, I urge you to come to our fall homecoming, because we have their enormous representation of student research activities that have been done in collaboration with professors, and the quality of them is breathtaking. Everything from posters to video presentations and so forth. So right across disciplines. My goal would be to say that a research experience is a hallmark of being an undergraduate at McGill, and we're not all the way there yet, but we're moving very dramatically in that direction. So thank you for the question.
And a second related question from Pat Butler in Toronto. Yeah. I recently heard about a new initiative to enhance the student experience. Please expand on the advisory board that is being proposed.
Yeah, well, that's great, and thank you, Pat, for that question. We have a senior group of volunteers, in this case led by Kelly Meehan, who is a parent, not an alumna, but married to Senator Michael Meehan, who is an alumnus and very, very involved, a governor emeritus of McGill and one of the co-chairs of our campaign. They, as parents, and I think for Michael as a governor, were very, very interested in this issue of the student experience, and gave a donation, a very generous donation, to help us consolidate a service point that would be of particular advantage to first-year students getting started. But we also then, coming off the task force, have advising and mentoring initiatives underway to build on that as well. But we're very excited about a volunteer-led effort to give us guidance and advice, but also to provide some support to this area.
Joan, I think her name is Tusi, she's from Champaign, Illinois, and is asking the following question, which I'm sure you'll have an easy answer for. I'm aware that McGill has a fundraising presence in Hong Kong, China. What other plans are there for fundraising efforts in international locations, including the United States?
Great question, Joan, and we don't have, the only office we have offshore, if you will, or out of the country, speaking to the United States, is in Hong Kong, as you know, and that's actually a question for this guy. What are our plans going forward? But we're to not joke about it, seriously looking at where we might have one or two other presences. And I know many of the American universities do this, a number of other Canadian universities do. We need to look at the return on the costs that would be expended in doing that. In Hong Kong, there's no question it. There's an immediate benefit that's felt from that. And our Hong Kong alumni have been very generous in supporting us and supporting, frankly, fellowships and scholarships and bursaries for students coming from that part of the world here and indeed for our research collaborations as well. Given how close the U.S. is and how much mobility there is of our professors and our students, and the fact that we're a member of the Association of American Universities, have very close relationships with our consuls general in the various big American cities, I think it would need to be demonstrated that there would be a real value add to going in that direction. And I don't know if you want to, I'm not to be interviewing you, but Vice Principal Weinstein, what do you think about that question? Because it's an important issue. It gets back to communicating, it gets back to connecting and how we make people feel like they're part of the enterprise and we're part of their lives and enriching their...
Well, I would say in the last couple of years, ever since we started Campaign McGill in 2007 in a public way, we've had a much greater penetration in the United States than we've ever had before. We've raised significant dollars from the United States.
And we have a big American student body.
We have a very large American student body and a very large parent body as well.
Yeah.
And we also have someone locally based in San Francisco who covers Western United States.
You're right.
But we do have someone.
Yeah, on the ground.
But I do think it does, a great person. Great
Patrick
individual,
Gutteridge.
Patrick Gutteridge. And I think it does take a bit of thinking ahead about how we want to build these types of operations. They're costly, but they're very significant in terms of branding McGill and also outreaching to McGill.
One of the great things about the colleague who Mark mentioned, Patrick Gutteridge, is he was at McGill and here on the ground and inside the place before going out west. And I think he actually represents the Western regions, not just California. So he has a great ability, I think, to be a fabulous bridge between our partners in California and our alumni and friends in California and frankly, British Columbia and the surrounding states to California. Maybe that's a model that we should deploy a bit more.
I have another question back to the government and the tuition situation. And this comes from Robert Picard in Richmond, British Columbia. How are universities in Quebec, including McGill's, advising the Ministry of Education to resolve the current student protest movement on the tuition issue?
Well, given how sensitive that is and that it's in process, let me just say we're very actively engaged in communicating with the minister and the government.
Well, let me move into a more personal moment and a few questions about you and about your term here at McGill and everything you've accomplished and everything you continue to do for the university. And you come from this is a very interesting vantage point, and that is, to me, you epitomize what a leader should be. But what do you think makes a great leader?
Well, that's a great question. and I certainly don't hold myself up as the gold standard on that. But I'll talk to you about some of the themes that are very resonant for me. One is that you have to really care about the place you're representing and the people in it. And I see some people who take on leadership roles, I'm not talking just about universities, but leadership in general, who like the idea of being a leader and who are dedicated and smart in what they do, but who really don't have... You could call it a passion or you could call it a biochemistry for doing what they're doing. And I think, this is actually a mentor of mine, a former professor of mine said to me, if you're ever offered a job, remember that the ego gratification lasts 15 minutes and then life begins. So your family's happy, you're happy, and then you wake up and you're in the job. And so you have to really think about what is it you're doing day in and day out, and is it exhilarating for you? Do you care about it? Do you like the people? And do you like the cause? And I think if you don't have that, again, I'll call it biochemistry or DNA, whatever it is, the demands are too great. And there are real sacrifices in taking on very big, complex leadership roles. And you have to have the energy, enthusiasm, and optimism to go through the inevitable ups and downs that an organization is going to face, and to stay focused on the purpose. So that's point number one. Number two, you got to listen and learn. And one of the things that I know for myself is I learn every day, and I don't think of myself as a perpetual student alone. But I would say learning is one of the great joys of my life, and you can imagine being in a university context. And in the range of leadership roles we have across the university, there's just a thrill every day. And on a day where bad stuff's happening, there are so many great things happening. From you can walk into a lab and see the discovery taking place. You can see the thrill of meeting with our outstanding young students. frankly, people walking across our beautiful campuses, falling in love. It is springtime in Montreal. All these things are rewarding, reinforcing, fueling of the job. And you know, at the end of the day, you have to care about the cause because, and this may become the theme of leadership. There are politics to deal with in any leadership position, but if you are a politician and not committed to being a leader, I think you'll fail. You may succeed as an individual, but you will fail in representing your cause. And so that's there's a press always to, you know, manage the politics or public relations, whatever it is. For me, you know, I grew up with five brothers in a rough and tumble family, and you know, we always focus on, you know, what should we be doing, not how to promote it. So
right.
Those are some of the things.
But some of us would maybe say that we see you as a role model in a leadership capacity way. So what are some of the strengths? And I'm going to ask this question: what are some of the weaknesses that you feel you have?
Yeah. Well, one of the things that this will sound amazingly naive, but maybe it's a product and part of growing up in a family with five brothers. Although my mother was, you know, she never would have called herself a feminist, but she was sure on themes of women's rights from the earliest moment I can remember. When I was appointed principal, and that day that every new university leader has when the media are meeting with you, what shocked me was how all anybody wanted to talk about was being the first female principal at McGill. And it kind of, you know, wasn't how I'd thought of myself. And what I realized then in the days that ensued, as I was meeting with people out in the community, not just people in McGill, but of the community, was I would have, you know, older immigrant men. I would have people from different racial backgrounds coming up and holding my hand and saying, it is so fabulous to see a woman appointed. And I thought, oh, you know, difference.
You can play a
significant difference
game.
Is important,
right.
And you have to own and be responsible for that. I guess another experience of that is understanding, and this reflects my background in social work and psychology, that as a leader, you're a walking Rorschach test. There are people who love you because you're holding an office. There are people who hate you because you're holding that office. I actually had a colleague say to me one time, you know, we would be friends except you decided to go, you know, in quotes, the administration route and not remain a colleague. That was at a different university. So you have to get past the Rorschach test elements, and I think I'm pretty good at doing that. I'm not impressed sort of by kind of non-substantial engagement. On the weaknesses side, you know, I do not see myself as a role model for young men or young women who
really
think about having a, well, I hope in some ways I might be, I hope on my values and so forth, but on work-life balance, I would say I'm, you know, not a good role model. And it reflects my temperament part, I get, you know, just I'm enormously engaged by my work. I always have been. I was industrious as a child, you know, it's just, I like doing stuff, you know. But I do think it's more important for young people starting out. They're not going to be in one role or one career. They're going to move from one to another. And what you have in life and at the end of the day is all the parts of your life and your health, your family and your friends. And you know, I think giving each its proper place is really important.
Right.
I've benefited from having an extraordinarily supportive husband and of long standing. We fell in love as teenagers and a daughter who's extremely supportive as well.
Wonderful. Well, I think it takes those kinds of ingredients to
do
the job that you do.
Yeah.
So on a personal note, what would you say might be on your bucket list after your term here at McGill? What's the thing you'd want to do?
I have zero interest in thinking beyond the work that we're doing right now.
Mm-hmm.
McGill will be a big part of that,
right.
And maybe a little more of that family-friend balance. You know, maybe actually doing yoga every morning instead of thinking about doing it and only doing it once in a while.
Right.
But no, in terms of my work, This is the domain I'm in, and we've got an ambitious agenda ahead.
We're very lucky to have you as our principal.
Thank you.
I have one last question that sort of ties all of this up very nicely, and it comes from Cynthia Shewin from Chicago. In addition to financial support for alumni, what are some other opportunities to support McGill?
Okay, well, thank you very much, Cynthia, for that question. I believe fundamentally that our alumni should be our best ambassadors. So we need to be supporting you and serving you with everything from allowing you to network with the people you want to enriching your own intellectual development and learning, but really being a champion for McGill and for what we do in the context we're in. I think there's no university in the world, and we have a great system of universities here in Quebec and in Canada broadly, and many in the world, but I don't think there's a university anywhere where the quality and impact of the place is achieved at the level of resources we've got. It's really a result of our commitment and that of the thousands of people who make up the university. So being our ambassador for how well we do, sending great people to us is really important. Our alumni and friends are a great source of wonderful young students who may or may not think about coming to McGill, but who, hearing about your own views, and that means you're coming back to McGill, all of you, and knowing McGill today, and being able to animate that in a way that excites people who might be thinking of coming here. Indeed, our alumni have been important as well in bringing professors here as we've been in this massive renewal and recruitment mode. It's a demographic change that's taking place in many universities. And frankly, giving us your criticism, your advice, your candid feedback. Your friends are your best source of reliable and trustworthy information, giving suggestions about how we might improve. Think of Kelly and Michael Meehan and what their own engagement in enhancing the quality of the early undergraduate experience has done to make McGill better. I think of Arthur Lau, who's online, who is Governor Emeritus, who's very active with us in our work in Hong Kong, connecting us, expanding our network for again, research and talent purposes, as well as to develop resources. All of those things, giving us your smart ideas, being part of our life and having us be part of yours.
So we've had an engaging hour of conversation, Heather, and it would be very appropriate for you to have the last word to our community at large and to our alumni and friends and parents worldwide.
Yeah. So well, let me just say thank you for tuning in today. Please do, going back to the earlier question, let us know what ways of communicating with you make sense. Come and visit, please. Come to our McDonald campus as well as our downtown campus, and see what we're doing. The infrastructure development, our wonderful development of our hospitals. You'll see the McGill University Health Center just flying up this massive complex. It'll be one of the most exciting health sciences complexes in North America. It, with our other three major hospitals, a huge part of our network. So lots of great things here, and stay connected, and thank you. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.